Hari Hari Bo. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. I want to thank all the assembled devotees, Suhas Prabhu, Archita Prabhu, for giving me the chance to address you all. Hopefully it is meaningful, maybe even inspiring, and that we all take away something that is useful in our practical devotional lives. Hare Krishna. So we are reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam. This is the third canto, and it's the status quo. And chapter 10 is entitled Divisions of the Creation, and verses 22 through 26. So this is how we're going to do it. Verses 22 through 25, all chant the Sanskrit solo, and the verses, the translation solo. And then when we get to verse 26, we'll just have one or two gentlemen and one or two ladies chant the Sanskrit responsively, and then we'll move on to the class. And since today is the day after Ekadasi and we're all anxious to break fast, I'm going to try my best to get everyone out of here by 8:30, if not earlier. Okay. So verse 22, again, I'll chant solo the Sanskrit and the translation.
Gaura Rajo Mahisha Krishna Sukaro Gavayo Rudahu Dvisabhak Pashavashcheme Avir Ushtrashta Satama.
Translation, O purest Vidura, of the lower animals, the cow, goat, buffalo, Krishna stag, hog, Gavaya animal, deer, lamb, and camel all have cloven hooves. Cloven hooves means cleft, means they're split in two. Oh, does it say that? Okay. Verse 23,
Karo svo shvataro gaura sharabhas chamari tatha iti chayka sabhak chatak shirunu pancha nakan pashun.
The horse, mule, ass, gaura, that means the white deer, sharabha, bison, and wild cow all have only one hoof. Now you may hear from me about the animals who have five nails. Verse 24.
Shvasrigalo vriko vyaghuro marjarak shasha shanakau singha kapir gajakurno godhacha makaradayaha.
Translation. The dog, jackal, tiger, fox, cat, rabbit, sajaru, lion, monkey, elephant, tortoise, alligator, gosapa, etc., all have five nails in their claws. They are known as pancha nakhas, or animals having five nails.
Verse 25, kanka gridhara bakasyena basa baluka varhinaha Hamsasarasa chakrava kakoluka dayakagaha.
The heron, vulture, crane, hawk, bhasa, baluka, peacock, swan, sarasa, chakravaka, crow, owl, and others are the birds. Okay, now we will chant this responsively, line by line.
Ardhavak shrotastu navamak. Chattar eka vidho nurnam. Rajo dikak korma pura. Dukhe cha sukamaninaha. Ardhavak shrotastu navamak. Chattareka vidho nuranam. Rajo dikak kurma pura. Dukhe cha sukaman inaha.
Okay, again, please, just three gentlemen and two gentlemen and a couple of ladies, please chant and then we'll move along. Vasprabhu? Oh, Mara, sorry. Oh, would you like to chant? Please.
Nirvak Shrota Stu Nabamaha. Nam Rajo Dikak Purma Pura Duke Chasuka Man in the Hall. Rajo Shrota Stu Marina. Rajo Dika Kurma Pura Duke Chasukama.
Ladies, please.
Anvaks Rotas to Navamaha. Jatar Eka Vidho Nirnam. Rajo Dika Kurma Pura Duke cha sukaman in ha.
Anyone else? Okay. Word for word. Please repeat. Ardhavak. Downwards.
Shrotaha.
Passage of food.
To.
But.
Navamaha.
The ninth.
Chataha.
O Vidura.
Eka vidha,
one species,
nirnam,
of human beings,
urarajaha,
the mode of passion,
adhikaha,
very prominent,
karma paraha,
interested in working,
dukhe,
in misery,
cha.
But,
sukha,
happiness,
maninaha,
thinking. Translation, the creation of the human beings who are of one species only and who stock their eatables in the belly is the ninth in the rotation. In the human race, the mode of passion is very prominent. Humans are always busy in the midst of miserable life, but they think themselves happy in all respects. Please repeat. The creation of the human beings, who are of one species only, and who stock their eatables in the belly, is the ninth in the rotation. In the human race, the mode of passion is very prominent. Humans are always busy in the midst of miserable life, but they think themselves happy in all respects. Srila Prabhupada's purport. The human being is more passionate than the animals, and thus the sex life of the human being is more irregular. The animals have their due time for sexual intercourse, but the human being has no regular time for such activities. In fact, brahmacharis have no time for such activities. The human being is endowed with a higher advanced stage of consciousness for getting relief from the existence of material miseries. But due to his ignorance, he thinks that his higher consciousness is meant for advancing in material comforts, in the material comforts of life. Thus, his intelligence is misused in the animal propensities, eating, sleeping, defending, and mating, instead of spiritual realization. By advancing in material comforts, the human being puts himself into a more miserable condition, But illusion by the material energy, he always thinks himself happy, even while in the midst of misery. Such misery of human life is distinct from the natural, comfortable life enjoyed even by the animals. Om Agnana Timirandasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshu Unmiridam Jena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. Today's class is divided into four parts. Part one, are all scientists demons? Part two, have I caught the disease of mechanistic science? Part three, are we crazy if we believe the Vedic view? And part four, the curse of being human. So part one, are all scientists demons? So one of Srila Prabhupada's most crucial outreach programs, we also call them preaching programs, was to systematically challenge the view that life comes from matter. In 1979, the BBT published Life Comes from Life, which was a series of impromptu talks by Srila Prabhupada in Los Angeles in 1973. In Life Comes from Life, Prabhupada warns us of the extent to which we are all affected by the pervading mechanistic view of the universe. In fact, in early 1977, in Bhubaneswar, India, Sarvabdhamana Goswami, a chemist, admitted to Prabhupada that he had no idea about the extent of the problem. So what exactly is that problem? Well, I may call myself a believer. I may have firm faith in the existence of God, but unless I have thorough, scientific, shastric knowledge of who God is and how he creates the cosmos, my beliefs are at best sentimental and therefore easily overridden by the mechanistic view of the universe. In other words, the impersonal mechanistic view of the universe is so all-pervading and powerful that the only way to counter it is by widely teaching the personalist Vedic view as presented in the Srimad Bhagavatam. So Prabhupada usually spoke in general terms condemning the scientists, but that always created a kind of confusion in my mind because I assumed that he meant that all scientists and by extension all science were demonic in nature, but that didn't jibe exactly with my experience. But my senior godbrother, Hridayananda Maharaj, made an interesting distinction. He said that there's the philosophy known as scientism, and then there's what is known as applied science. Scientism versus applied science. So how are they different? So scientism claims that science alone can reveal the truth about the world and reality. Science alone can reveal the truth about the world and reality. But applied science is the use of scientific conclusions to attain practical goals. The use of scientific conclusions to attain practical goals. And as an aside, Hridayananda Maharaj used to say that every time he sits down in the dentist's chair, he thanks God for applied science. So as I just stated, scientism and applied science are quite different. We know that scientism is diametrically opposed to theism and is therefore atheistic. But if applied science is different from scientism, is applied science always squeaky clean and innocent? Well, not necessarily. Applied science is responsible for advances in medicine and in communication, but it's also responsible for strip mining and nuclear warheads. Applied science provides cleaner energy, but it also created factory farming. So how do we, as aspiring devotees of Krishna, attempt to reel in the pernicious effects of scientism and of destructive applied science? I have nothing new to offer. We do it by becoming more and more sincere in our spiritual practices and by becoming confident and educated enough to teach the public about these issues. purity within and dynamism without, determined on the inside and relentless on the outside. Part two, have I caught the disease of mechanistic science? So what are two words that even devotees use if they don't think about it? One of those words is instinct, as in birds build their nests based on instinct. Lower animals have limited consciousness, limited volition. But to say that animals act and react based on instinct robs them of any volition. Prabhupada explains that animals act based on learned behavior and guided by the supersoul within. But the term instinct removes will, learning, and the supersoul from the animal's existence. Now, isn't that convenient? The concept of instinct removes the individual consciousness and the supreme consciousness from the life of a being who, while not in a very advanced condition, is still a beloved creature of God. The second term I was thinking of is mutation, or mutate, as in the original COVID virus mutated into Delta, which then mutated into Omicron. So the Vedic view explains that there are millions of powerful universal administrators who oversee extremely detailed aspects of universal management. So the Vedic view would be that the so-called new strains of the virus are not mutations. They are directly created by one or more universal administrators to rectify human society for ignoring the presence and the order of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. In fact, my guess is that the Vedic view throws out the idea of mutation completely, which is based on impersonalism. The mechanistic scientific view is everywhere. When a so-called scientist declares that a fish feels no pain when it's hooked through the mouth, because the scientist loves to eat fish and wants to ease his conscience, that's the kind of science that Prabhupada railed against. Now remember, Prabhupada in his earlier life was a pharmacist, and pharmacy is an applied science. Scientism, on the other hand, renders virtually everything in the universe except humans as dead, and thus makes everything fair game for human exploitation. Just as our bodies can be either exploited for sense pleasure or used in Krishna's service, the earthly body, or Mother Bhumi, can be exploited for demonic aims, what Krishna refers to in the Bhagavad Gita as ugra, karma, horrible works, or it can be used in service to Krishna, as when its natural produce, fruits, vegetables, grains, flowers, and jewels are offered in love to Krishna and used in his service. The psychologist Carl Jung invented the term the inner child. Now, the inner child is a deep part of our subconscious that picked up messages before we were able to process their meaning. And therefore, these messages exert a heavy influence on us for the rest of our life. I like the term the inner atheist, which says that because I was raised in a culture that swears by scientism, and because scientism is covered atheism, or actually anti-theism, that anti-theism is practically an indelible part of my core being. Therefore, part of my spiritual task is to notice when and where I subscribe to mechanistic science over the Vedic view and gradually purify myself of its effects. Part three, are we crazy if we believe the Vedic view? So one of the biggest challenges of some devotees in fully adopting the Vedic view is that the Vedic view differs radically from our mechanistic worldview. In fact, some experienced devotees parted company with the movement because of such differences. For example, regarding time, modern science sees time as something that elapses at a systematic rate and is best measured by bombarding cesium with microwaves. In other words, time is an impersonal, mechanistic something that has no particular meaning, no specific source, and is basically meant to serve our interests. But the Vedic view of time is completely personal and purposeful. Time is the hand of God, moving the living entities through their karmic outcomes based on their past activities. Speaking of cosmic creation, mechanistic scientists come up with one theory after another, but they really have no idea how or when the universe came to be. The Bhagavatam, on the other hand, addresses cosmic creation again and again throughout its pages. In this chapter, the Bhagavatam speaks of 9 sub-creations. 1 through 4 are the creation of the total material ingredients, of the false ego, then of sense perception, and then knowledge and working capacity. The 5th sub-creation is that of the universal managers, and the 6th is the darkness of ignorance. The 7th is of immovable entities, the 8th of lower species, and the 9th in the rotation is of human beings. Vedic view also has a unique system of species classification that is very different from the modern scientific view. For example, today's verses classify animals as those having cloven or cleft hooves, those having a solid hoof, and those having 5 nails. Now, because Prabhupada didn't find English equivalents for some of the animals listed in verses 22 through 25, I tried to find those equivalents, and here's what I came up with. In verse 22, Prabhupada translates gavaya simply as gavaya animal, and a Google search came up with either wild ox or wild cow. Verse 23 mentions the word karaha or ass and ashvatthara or mule. So what's the difference between an ass and a mule? An ass is a wild donkey, and a mule is when a donkey mates with a horse. In verse 24, Prabhupada translates shalakau as, quote, sajaru with thorns on the body, end quote, and a Google search came up with porcupine. Also in verse 24, Prabhupada translates godha as, quote, gosapa, snake with 4 legs, so a Google search came up with iguana. Verse 24 mentions the word shrigalaha or jackal. I had to look up what exactly a jackal is, and I found that jackals look like a cross between a fox and a German shepherd. They have the small face and fluffy tail of the fox, but they have the long, alert ears of the German shepherd. So I learned that jackals live in southern Asia and in Africa. In verse 25, the word bhasa has no English equivalent, so a Google search came up with vulture, and the word sarasa also had no equivalent, so a search came up with crane. The beginning of verse 26 reads, "The creation of the human beings, who are of one species only, and who stalk their eatables in the belly, is the 9th in the rotation." So why does the Bhagavatam say that human beings are of one species only? Well, the cloven-hooved animals, for example, are one in category, but are comprised of many different species. The human beings, on the other hand, come in many shapes, sizes, and colors, but they are only one species. Part 4, the curse of being human. In the purport to verse 26, Prabhupada writes, quote, "By advancing in material comforts, the human being puts himself into a more miserable condition, but illusioned by the material energy, he always thinks himself happy, even while in the midst of misery. Such misery of human life is distinct from the natural, comfortable life enjoyed even by the animals." I was a bit puzzled by Srila Prabhupada's description of animals as enjoying a natural, comfortable life. Except for pampered indoor animals, most animals are always afraid, always hungry, or both. But I think Prabhupada's use of the term natural, comfortable life refers to the fact that animals don't spend time trying to improve their lives beyond what nature provides. They don't build skyscrapers. They don't hoard gold. And they don't try to attract followers or convince others that their philosophy is the best. Rather, they accept what nature offers them in terms of food and lodging and leave it at that. So, if human beings showed the same wisdom as animals in that regard, they would also be living a natural, comfortable life. Later in the purport, Prabhupada writes, "The human being is more passionate than the animals, and thus the sex life of the human being is more irregular. The animals have their due time for sexual intercourse, but the human being has no regular time for such activities. I want to tell a story. Well, it's not a story exactly, but because it's true. In a class by His Holiness, Hanumat Prasak Swami, he spoke of a young Indian gentleman he knew. I was guessing the young man was probably 25 or so. And this young man came from an aristocratic Brahmin family. The young man wanted to get married, so true to the Indian customs, his parents got together with a prospective bride's parents, and they agreed on the match. So what happened next? Did they get married and move in together? Well, not exactly. In fact, not at all. What happened? Rather, once a week for a 3-year period, this young gentleman had dinner with his prospective bride in her parents' home. There was no physical contact, only conversation. During this time, they got to know each other very well and became quite attached to each other, and only then did they get married. Now, in another anecdote from Hanumat Prasak Swami, when he spoke independently to 3 Indian men, each of them said that they had not discharged semen before the age of 25, the age at which the brain is fully formed. Now, whether these men had responded to something their fathers had taught them or simply the restraint inherent in Indian culture is unclear, and it's not that important. But what is important? The couple I just mentioned had practiced 3 years of restraint in their courtship, which then made it possible to practice restraint in their marriage. And because the 3 young men had grown up practicing restraint, it made it possible for them to also practice restraint in courtship and then in marriage. But most of us Westerners, particularly us older fogies, were not trained in that way. In my parents' generation, most girls remained virgins until marriage. In a study conducted in the United States, only 12% of women born prior to 1910 admitted to having premarital sex. But when the so-called sexual revolution of the 1960s unfolded, any sense of restraint was thrown out the window. So the cards were stacked against us. So what's the importance of restraint? Well, reasonable restraint, I'm not talking about the white knuckle, sweaty palm, tension headache type of restraint practiced by pseudo-renunciates, but sustainable restraint is key to our advancement in Sarada Bhakti, for it helps us to curb the unlimited urgings that constantly harass the embodied soul, and we can focus instead on our transcendental practice. If we are blessed to find a service and an ashram that is suitable for our makeup, if we apply ourselves with full enthusiasm to the orders of our spiritual master, peppered with plenty of hearing and chanting of Krishna's glories and healthy association with the devotees, our success in Krishna consciousness is guaranteed. So today I pose the questions, are all scientists demons? Have I caught the disease of mechanistic science? Are we crazy if we believe the Vedic view? And I briefly address the curse of being human. So thanks for your kind attention. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Hari Hari Bol. I'm ill-equipped to answer questions, but if you want to take a risk, you can try. And I'll refer the question to Brigopati or someone more qualified. Any questions? Any comments? I hope I didn't say anything too controversial.
No, thank you. Thank you for a very scholarly, intellectually respectable class. It's obviously you did a lot of research, a lot of preparation, and it's very much appreciated. So my question is like this. This morning I had this is addressing point 3 of your topics. Are we crazy for buying into the Vedic worldview? So I don't know how I got there, but I found myself when I was chaining my japa looking at a purport that's coming up in a week or so. It's the second to last text of the next chapter, Divisions of Time and the Atom, and it's talking about the structure and the dimensions of the universe. So there's 2 verses. One is saying how the about the different layers, you know, and how the actual diameter of the universe is 4 billion miles across, And the first layer is Earth, and that's 10 times as thick as the diameter of the universe. The next covering is water, and that's 10 times as thick as the Earth covering, on and on and on, you know, out for the eight material elements. And Prabhupada himself in the purport said that the inner inhabited part of the universe is like an atom in comparison to the rest of the universe with all the coverings. And then the verse itself says that these atoms are clustered together. And some of the universes are considerably bigger than the one we're in. And the universes are like clustered together. And, you know, that's the picture of reality. And I just found that really difficult to to relate to, you know. And then, you know, then I looked down at my hand, my arm, and I'm looking at a hair, and I just remembered, oh, the tip of the hair, if you divide that into 100 parts and then take one of those parts and to divide that into 100 parts, that's the size of the soul. So I just started thinking to myself. And then I, when I went home, to be honest with you, I went on the internet and I just typed in, I Google searched, like you very fond of doing, size of the universe. And, you know, you get a totally different picture of reality. What to speak of 4 billion miles across, you get information, you know, it's like 4 billion light years, actually to the closest galaxies or something like that. So it's like a totally different picture of reality. And like you pointed out, there's scientism and applied science, which implies that these guys aren't total idiots. If you know that we were using, like Ridhananda Maharaj said, thank God when he sits in a dentist chair. And they're obviously got some stuff right because, you know, look what they can do. So they have telescopes. Are we just to throw everything that they're saying out, thinking this is like they're crazy, they don't know what they're talking about, and accept the Vedic version, which is pretty inconceivable? How are we supposed to relate to it? I mean, in a class that I gave when I kind of touched upon this point, I would make the point that Krishna consciousness can't be understood by the blunt material senses. And I quoted that verse of Takshri Krishnanamadi and also something from the sixth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, Buddhi Graya Matinjam, it's understood by transcendental senses, purified senses. And that's why these things are so hard to relate to and understand. What is your take on that?
What is my take on that is that there are some things that will never be able to square away, I believe, between these two vastly divergent views. They're just so different and incompatible, and they come from extremely different sources. One is, you know, we grow up to believe that the more complex a device is, the more accurate it is. So the more complex a telescope is, it must be more and more and more accurate. But I say that the formula upon which things are built is defective. So it's not necessarily true that the more complex something is, the more accurate or more believable or more impressive that it is. Ultimately, prayer, number one, how do I reconcile these things? Can I reconcile these two divergent views? And secondly, it's not that important. It really isn't that important because, in other words, we can spend so much time considering different religious views that may go against what we've learned from the Srimad Bhagavatam. But if we spend too much energy trying to reconcile those two, you could say that it's a bit of an over-endeavor or a bit of a waste of time. So again, I just fall back on there are some things that we may learn with a great deal of realization, but until we get to that stage of realization, it's just, I don't know. I believe what Prabhupada has taught us, and ultimately it's not that important, and let me focus my time on pleasing Prabhupada, because part of it is that tendency to mentally speculate, oh, is it this, is it that, is it this, is it that? And it's probably not healthy to give too much energy, give too much attention to that tendency to try to figure things out. Because again, as I said, I think there are things that we'll never really figure out with our itsy-bitsy little brain. And it's when our heart enlarges that we can understand things much, much better. So I don't know if that helps, but excellent question. Thank you so much. All right. Prabhu. Microphone, please.
Hare Krishna, Prabhu. Thanks for a very nice presentation.
Thank you.
The first question on the table is consciousness. That's where you stop them. If you can't explain consciousness, then why should I accept your conscious view of the universe? First of all, explain consciousness. Who are you? You're speaking, you know you're conscious, I know I'm conscious, we're having a conscious conversation. But you can't explain consciousness. At least we have some idea of what it is. We present that, like Prabhupada would say. You're looking for God. You say you don't know who is God. I'm telling you Krishna is God. Krishna says he's God. So many great personalities have accepted him as God. And we can give you a formula for figuring out who is God. Why not accept? So the onus is on them, not on us. We can explain what consciousness is. You may accept the explanation or not. But we say there's a supremely conscious being from whom everything comes and we're a part and parcel of him, so we're also conscious. What's your explanation? Oh, somehow, somewhere, sometime, under some conditions, material elements became conscious. Somehow. We can't explain it and we can't replicate it, but you have to accept it. No, we don't. Sorry, sir. Hare Krishna.
Yeah, excellent. Sarvadamodar Maharaj was at a conference of scientists. And he said, if I give you, he addressed one in particular, if I give you all the ingredients that form the human body, can you create life out of that? And the scientist, in quotes, said, I don't know. So he was defeated. His whole premise is based on this just vast invention. And yet, when it came down to it, he said, I don't know. He doesn't know if he can create life. Well, of course he can't. Of course he can't. Prabhu.
I would just say that our system is producing living entities like Srila Prabhupada and Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, Narada Muni. And I don't know what their system is producing, but I don't think there's any comparison between the kind of individuals that come out of their background. And our philosophy produces Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So the proof of a better system is in the result. The world is messed up, not because there's too many devotees on the planet. We need more devotees. So I just want to say that as evidence.
Excellent point. And you get someone with the potency of Srila Prabhupada, and he can take the outsiders and turn them into insiders, basically, into, you know, saintly people, practically. Yeah. Such an annoying Prabhu.
Friends of the whole universe.
Thank you, Prabhu. That was a very, very elaborated research.
Thank you.
And you mentioned that, you know, different opinions, different views. And actually, there's nothing new. This is coming all the way to the beginning of creation. When Lord Krishna and Uddhava are having a conversation, one of the first questions he asked to Lord Krishna, Uddhava said, my dear Lord, there are many different views, different philosophers. Please tell me which is the best. And after that, Lord Krishna started revealing the whole creation, how the universe was created and annihilated, and later on was created, and starting with Lord Brahma, the sages, and he went to the Kinaras, Purushas, Guhyatas, the Rakshasas, the atheists, and human beings. And each one of them has a different leader. And he says each one of them will propone their views. But ultimately, all this together is what? It's just to make that living entity happy, meaning with that kind of philosophy or point of view. And he said, Krishna at the end, I'm just paraphrasing. He says, ultimately, he says, all these things that have been created will never make them happy. And then the conclusion, of course, is bhakti or devotional service. Until they surrender to my lotus feet, then they will be happy. And it's all question and based on authority. Who do you accept as an authority? That's the bottom line. Because, you know, many views, many points. Okay. I'm just to recall this incident at the airport one time, distributing books. And I'm just a simple village boy. What do I know? And this guy has a big book about the theories of creation and evolution. And he said, what can you tell me? He said, there's a challenge. And the first thing about, you know, the world, the existence, and I thought, oh, my God. I said, I'm not really qualified of this, but one thing I would tell you, you know, a thing that came to my mind was my, you know, everything is based in authority, and we accept this authority, and you have your own authorities. And Srila Bhaktisiddhanta said that I don't read any books. I read the author, meaning that he, the character. So more or less, I kind of point that view to him. Who do you follow? You read in these books, what is the character of the people behind that, ultimately? And, you know, he couldn't answer, but so is everything based on authority?
Excellent. And we accept Prabhupada's authority.
Yeah.
Hare Bol, thank you very much. Hare Krishna, glories Prabhupada.